What's up? Welcome to the Chengdu Gaming Federation podcast. My name is Charlie. I'm joined here by Austin.
What up?
Today we're going to be talking about, I guess, some of our favorite games from the last couple of years fit into this category, which is sort of one which has experienced a big resurgence in the last 10 years or so. That is the roguelikes category of games.
Right.
Which we're talking about today. There's actually a lot about this genre of games which I didn't know. And I didn't really know how little I knew until I really started reading about the history of this genre of games.
I read up quite a bit on it a while back when I started getting into games like Binding of Isaac and FTL. Just, I think, really interesting genre for me. But those games differ a lot from where the games originally came from.
Yeah, the original games which created this, one of the big ones is actually called Rogue from 1980.
Right.
Is not a game that I'd ever heard of. And when I think of where does roguelikes come from, well, I don't know. It's kind of funny to learn that it comes from a game called Rogue,
right,
which I had never played, which was released before I was born. So there's no reason why I would play it. It's not something that was around when I was a child. But in any case, the history of this genre is pretty interesting. What I've always thought of it as, for people who, there are a couple common elements of roguelike games, which we'll talk about in this podcast. But when I think of roguelike, what I think of is permadeath and procedural generation. Exactly. And that's, I guess, how I would define this. What do you think of when you think roguelikes? Definitely Binding of Isaac.
Yeah, Binding of Isaac, FTL. I mean, Heavy Bullets, I guess, would be a good one as well, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure that is. Yeah. That's a great one. That's one that might not come up so much. I feel like when you talk about roguelikes, Binding of Isaac for sure is going to be one of the first thing that comes
Spelunky.
Spelunky also one of the huge ones.
I think maybe 2010, around that time, is when we saw a resurgence of games that would be coined roguelite. Or roguelike-like.
Roguelike-like. Yeah, that's another genre too. That's right.
But these are putting what would typically be considered a roguelike element, such as procedural generation or the permadeath, into other genres.
That's right. Yeah. And so now it's no longer like a D&D-esque dungeon crawler, right, which is how the roguelike subgenre actually was created.
And they're more bite-sized, you know, something you can complete in one sitting, whereas the older games that the term comes from are multiple session gameplay. Game, come on, brain.
Yeah, Austin's struggling over there. I think what you're trying to say is, yeah, a lot of the games now are sort of more action-oriented, shorter session lengths than dungeon crawling RPGs, which had these sort of roguelike elements back in the 80s and 90s, and I think even before that in 1970s.
Right.
Although Rogue is considered to be the forerunner and the namesake of the genre, with derivative games mirroring Rogue's character or sprite-based graphics. Have you seen what it looks like?
Yeah, it's like ASCII characters.
Yeah, it's like a DOS. Yeah. It's a DOS-looking game.
I've played it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What do you remember about it?
It's slow and boring.
Really?
I mean, I think the genre's kind of come a long way since then. I think the first time the term roguelike was used was in the early 90s, though. Not until well after, you know, several games had come out in the genre mimicking Rogue's gameplay.
They didn't mimic the gameplay, right? I thought they just limited the procedural generation.
Similar turn-based... Turn-based, procedural generation, dungeon crawling, permadeath. Yeah.
Well, Rogue is basically sort of like a Dungeons & Dragons type game, and that's sort of where all these come from originally. According to Wikipedia, roguelike is a subgenre of role-playing video games characterized by a dungeon crawl through procedurally generated game levels, turn-based gameplay, tile-based graphics, and permanent death of the player character. So those are the most root elements, I guess, in the history of roguelikes. And then later it became roguelike likes, which were games which took some, like permadeath and procedural generation, and applied those to different types of games.
Like Abyss Odyssey, which is, what's that development team? Ace Software, I think. The people who did Xenoclash had a roguelike beat 'em up. You would just go down procedurally generated levels in a dungeon and develop your character's fighting abilities, but you would just do 2D like Tekken fighting.
I see. Yeah, I never played that game. I did see it mentioned in a couple places as I was reading to prepare for this podcast.
I picked it up as soon as it came out just because I really want to support those developers. They do interesting, weird stuff.
You know,
I like their artwork.
I had never really heard Rogue mentioned anywhere pretty much in like my whole life. And it was interesting to learn just recently that in 2009, Rogue was named number 6 on the top 10 greatest PC games of all time.
Wow, really?
By PC World. Yeah, exactly. So it's been credited, I guess, by some mainstream commentators with a large audience. But it's funny because I had never heard of it. You would think that there would be more of a mention of Rogue, the game which like literally gave the namesake of roguelike, especially since roguelike games are so big now.
Yeah.
But now when you look into this, the biggest ones you hear about are Weird Worlds, Return to Infinite Space, Spelunky, Binding of Isaac, FTL, and Rogue Legacy.
Yeah.
Those are kind of the classic really like modern roguelike games. Yeah, describe that one. I didn't play it too much. That's the one that works like on Ancestry?
Yeah, you start as a... Every time you die, you come back as your son or daughter or whatever and have genetic traits, whether it's dwarfism or... Just some of them are weird traits where you can only see things in 2D. Where like, so when you, even though the game's 2D, it's like when you turn around, you'll have a weird flip effect. But because it's just weird stuff like that, not okay. All gameplay altering stuff.
What but type of game is it actually though? Like, what's
similar
the
similar to Super Metroid?
Yeah, it's kind of Castlevania-ish.
Yeah,
almost.
And you have three different. Bosses, I think, that you go to fight, and you can go to them in any order you want. It's really cool.
Yeah, I didn't play that game too much. I have it on my Steam library along with hundreds of games, which I'm also neglecting. I played Spelunky a whole lot. Did you play that game a lot?
Never played Spelunky.
Spelunky is really, you know, it was actually Rami Ismail who I met, who's the co-founder of Lambeer, who made another well-known roguelike game, actually a roguelike
throne.
Yeah, a roguelike shooter called Nuclear Throne. I met him in Shanghai at GDC and we had a brief conversation and he mentioned how much he loves Spelunky and how much he's played the game and how he's played it for, I think he said he played it for 200 or 300 hours. Wow. And still hadn't finished it. And wow. He was like really trying to finish it, but it's just such a big, difficult game. And I thought, wow, like the depth of that game must be incredible. And so I went back and spent some time with Spelunky and really enjoyed it. For anyone who's unfamiliar, Spelunky is a 2008 game, which is considered to be a major contributor to the growth of indie-developed roguelike games. Developed by Derek Yu, who wanted to make deep gameplay, which roguelike offers, and combine it with the ease of use and accessibility of a platformer.
Right.
So it's almost sort of a Mario-esque spelunking game with roguelike qualities, where you are trying to... collect resources and save a princess. And there's a huge amount of deep gameplay inside the game and a great degree of replayability. This right. is kind of one of the most common attractive qualities of roguelikes, is that you can kind of play them
forever.
Almost forever. Yeah, exactly. And because of the procedural generation and the permadeath, there it's almost a different experience each time. You don't really know what's going to happen. And so it's kind of... very different from a linear story where you play it once and you know what's going to happen and there's right. no point in going back. Whereas with roguelikes, there generally is no story really. It's mostly just about the random elements combining together in unique ways.
Right.
Did you ever play the game which I just mentioned, the Weird Worlds game?
Never played it. Saw it on Steam, but never played it. The whole aesthetic of it looked kind of similar to Space Pirates and Zombies.
Right.
But... I think Space Pirates and Zombies came out well after that. That's a pretty old game, isn't it?
It's a pretty old game, I think, yeah. That was a major source of inspiration for FTL. But before we get on to FTL, Spelunky 2, the sequel, has been announced.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it going to come to Switch?
I'm not sure if they've announced platforms, but I think it's very likely that it will.
I hope so. That would be really cool.
I think that it's published by Nicolas, actually.
Cool.
Yeah, the same publisher as Cave Story. Exactly. And Cave Story Plus is available on Switch. And Switch seems like a perfect platform for Spelunky or Spelunky 2.
Yeah.
I don't think much is known about the sequel. So it will be interesting to see how such a classic roguelike game like Spelunky, one that has influenced so many games, would create a sequel. Like what
should
the approach will be.
On that. Yeah. The first one.
It'll be interesting to see if it changes very much or if it stays mostly the same. I feel like even if Spelunky, the original one, came out on Switch, that would be very successful on Switch.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because unlike Cave Story, it's a roguelike, and that means it's kind of perfect for pick-up-and-play gameplay. It's kind of perfect for a handheld, kind of makes sense on that platform, as does Enter the Gungeon, which is another big roguelike shooter.
Yeah, glad you got on that one. That game's great.
Yeah, that was one which I played on Steam. There's so many roguelikes, it's kind of hard to keep track of all of them. It's kind of like survival MMOs.
Yeah.
It's like there's so many, you know, it's hard to get into that. But I gave a shot, a second shot, actually, of Enter the Gungeon on Switch, and really enjoyed it there. And I had played it on Steam previously, mm-hmm. and it was fun, but I didn't get really hooked on it.
Being able to play it on the go is a huge thing, though. It's perfect for just pick up and like dive into it.
It's a huge thing, yeah. It is one of the most recommended games, I think, on the Switch. If you ask what are the independent games which you should get first on Switch, I think the first one's probably Celeste, which is the creator of Towerfall.
Yeah.
But after that, I would say probably one of the top games recommended is that game.
I would also really recommend Don't Starve. It doesn't have Don't Starve Together, sadly, but it's a single player game. It's a really good game.
That's a roguelike as well. That's like a survival roguelike.
If you don't have it for Steam, it's definitely worth picking up for Switch.
Let's describe some of these games first. So Enter the Gungeon is a shooting game where you're actually going through dungeons, like, procedurally generated dungeons.
I would say it's like Zelda if it were a twin stick bullet hell shooter.
Oh yeah, that kind of makes some sense. Yeah, exactly. It's very similar to Zelda dungeons where you're going back and forth between different rooms. You choose which way to go. You have a map. It's all very sort of traditional Zelda-like layout. Absolutely.
It's like Binding of Isaac, but with way crazier enemies and bullets and stuff.
Yeah, I would like to hear your description of Binding of Isaac once we finish up with Enter the Gungeon. But one of the things which I found best about Enter the Gungeon is there's so much content in the game.
Yeah, it's crazy.
There's hundreds of different weapons. And
there's
guns
that shoot guns.
Yeah, that's right.
That shoot bullets.
There's such a huge variation. And it definitely feels like every single time you play that game, you experience something different.
I really like the soundtrack in it, too. It's got a good soundtrack.
Real challenging game.
Yeah.
Good soundtrack. Great design, too. Looks like sort of 8-bit NES. And yeah, Enter the Gungeon, just overall really fantastic. Also, a huge degree of variation in the bosses, which is really nice.
Each stage, I think, has two or three different bosses that you have a chance of encountering.
I think to complete the game, you have to go through 5 levels.
Yeah,
right?
So
5 levels of dungeons.
There's got to be like 10 to 15 bosses or something.
I think there's even more than that. There's a lot. You can see them all in the encyclopedia, which I forget.
Only the ones you've encountered. The gun, the Ammonomicon.
Ammonomicon, that's it, exactly. Great job. In the Ammonomicon, you can see how many bosses there are. You just can't see their identity until you discover them. And same deal with the weapons. You can see there's like hundreds of different weapons. And as you play the game more and more, you start to reveal more of them. And then you can purchase them in the shop. There's a meta game as well, which is also common in roguelikes. So it's permadeath. So one run, you die, you start back at the beginning. But often you collect some kind of persistent currency, which you can use in a persistent marketplace.
Yeah, we talked about Death Road to Canada, I think, briefly. Been playing that, and that's got the Zombo points or whatever.
Exactly. Zombo points, the exact same thing, where on particular runs, you'll die. You have to start back at the beginning, but you have this persistent currency, and then you can spend that, and that will give you permanent abilities or attributes inside Death Road to Canada.
Enter the Gungeon, it's like, I think, different guns that you can get, and you can also talk to the engineer guy or whatever to work on an elevator to get to skip down to other levels.
There's so much content in that game. I think I've played Enter the Gungeon for maybe 40 hours or so. A whole lot of time.
Still haven't beat it.
I haven't even gotten close to beat it. I think I've got to the 3rd level. That's it, out of 5.
Yeah, I should pick that up for Switch.
You should. It's really great. When you talk about the best roguelike games, I think Enter the Gungeon's on that short list. I prefer it to Nuclear Throne. Very similar.
They're pretty similar. I really like Nuclear Throne. I think Nuclear Throne puts more of a focus on just the guns and shooting and dodging, whereas Enter the Gungeon has more focus on the exploration, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, so to put some time on some of these things, Nuclear Throne is a top-down shooter which was made by Vlambeer in Holland. And early prototypes of the game were distributed through Steam's early access program in 2013.
Wasteland Kings, I have that.
What is that?
That's the early prototype for it.
Wasteland Kings. Interesting. Yeah. I didn't play it then at all.
Yeah.
And so that was 2013 when that came out into early access. Spelunky was remade on Xbox 360 in 2012. I think that was part of the Xbox Live Summer Arcade.
Wow.
So that was 6 years ago, and then later it ported to every single console you can imagine. PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4. It's available on Vita. It's on Microsoft Windows. It's on Mac. It's available everywhere except for Switch.
Yeah. Is it on DS?
It's a good question. I'm not sure if it's on DS. It may be on DS. It's on a whole bunch of platforms. But that kind of really reignited interest in roguelikes. But tell me about Binding of Isaac, because I played the game briefly. I found it really disgusting. I was really confused by it, and I don't really understand what it's about. And you've played it for hundreds of hours, right?
Probably, yeah. There's a lot of poop in the game, which I like poop, I guess.
Why would they do that?
I don't know.
What's the game about?
So your mom, who is a Christian, I think, thinks she hears God telling her that she has to kill her son, and you run away into this basement dungeon and have to go down further and further levels to eventually fight your mom. You have different
what kind of enemies are you fighting?
Like Satan, like maybe weird enemies, poop, enemies that cry blood out of their eyes at you, stuff like that.
But have you finished the game? How long does it take?
I've got to mom, but I haven't been able to beat her. I'd say you could probably beat it in one playthrough, maybe 1 hour, 1 hour.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's really difficult, or why is it so hard to beat?
Super difficult, and there's a lot of just emphasis on getting lucky with the items. Hmm. You know, the random number generator.
Yeah, the RNG. The RNG is frequently complained about when it comes to this genre, because a lot of your progress in the game comes down to luck. Sometimes you just get a bad draw and you get screwed. Sometimes you get a good draw and things are really easy.
Yeah.
But luck is a huge factor in this genre in particular, much more so than in other genres.
I think that's part of the fun. When you get a lucky roll of the dice or whatever, it really makes you enjoy just having that power and being able to push through the game.
Yeah.
You appreciate it more because of all the hard times you've had with the game.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Is that a game which you played on Steam, or what platform did you play Binding of Isaac?
Played Binding of Isaac on my old laptop. Just carried it with me, played it on plane flights, whatever.
For some reason, that game seems pretty expensive on Switch. I think it's like $40 or something.
It is $40. It is kind of expensive. I think $30 might be reasonable. It's a lot of content. It's the Afterburst Plus one, I think, or whatever. They have updated the whole game. The game had two releases and had like a bunch of expansion packs for the original game. And then the whole game got made with a new remade with a new engine.
Is that the Afterbirth one?
There's Rebirth and Afterbirth and Afterbirth Plus.
And Afterbirth Plus must be the one on Switch.
Yeah.
I see.
And the Switch version is the only one that has co-op on it. You can play with four people.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So either you're four kids, your four brothers or something in that case. I don't know.
I think you play as a little ghost or something that follows them around and you shoot off to the side. They're not all kids.
Is there a story about why that game is so weird? Do you know?
I think it's just Edmund McMullen's a weird guy. Have you seen any of his other games?
No, is that the creator of the game? I don't even know who that is.
Yeah, okay. It's the guy who made the game, and he also did Super Meat Boy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is also kind of a weird...
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is
and,
a little weird.
And some of his older
it's
games...
It's like Super Meat Boy is supposed to be like a boy without skin?
Yeah.
And he's just like bleeding everywhere?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's definitely got some kind of weird concepts. His older games are also just bizarre stuff.
Interesting.
I have Edmund McMullen's Basement Collection, which is just a collection of a bunch of different games he made.
I see.
And they're all weird.
Yeah, well, Binding of Isaac seems to be the biggest one.
Yeah.
Super Meat Boy is actually very big also. When that became available on Switch just a couple of months ago, that was to great fanfare.
Yeah.
People really love that game. But Binding of Isaac and Enter the Gungeon in particular are two roguelike games on Switch where I know a huge number of people have played both those games for hundreds of hours.
But you don't like Binding. You just think it's gross and weird, right?
Yeah, I heard it compared to Zelda as well.
It's very like Zelda.
It is.
The layout of the levels and everything just looks like Zelda.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did strike me as being disgusting and weird, and I didn't really understand what was going on. I remember there's not a cutscene, but there's sort of a dialogue sequence at the beginning, which describes the situation with your mother, and it looks just like horrible abuse or something like that. And I just found that a little strange and weird.
Off-putting.
Yeah, it was very similar to Zelda. I could definitely feel that similarity. Yeah. And that's mentioned all the time. But I was also playing Nuclear Throne and Enter the Gungeon at the same time. And those two just seemed superior to me.
Right.
I get that Binding of Isaac is a much older game than those.
Yeah.
And so people, that was much of like a forebear of the roguelike genre than Enter the Gungeon or Nuclear Throne. So a lot of people have liked that game for a long time. I just missed it at that time. Like when it first came out and was like really big and influential, I just wasn't playing it for whatever reason.
Right.
So I have no nostalgia with Binding of Isaac. And I feel like especially on Switch, most of the people who would buy that at $40 are probably people who have nostalgia for that game.
I mean, I thought about buying it. I think I would buy Enter the Gungeon first, though.
Oh, yeah.
It's a better value.
I mean, I think it's $15.
Yeah.
It's a really inexpensive. It's fantastic. I mean,
versus $40 for Binding of Isaac.
Yeah. So whoever's listening to this, if you have a Nintendo Switch, definitely consider getting Enter the Gungeon. It's super good.
Let's talk about a few other titles. Have you played Risk of Rain? Oh, we played that online together once.
We played it briefly. Right? Yeah. Risk of Rain, I didn't feel like it was for me, you know?
I like loved
the,
it.
Yeah, the describe it. What's the game about?
It's not really a story, is there? You just kind of start out in this two-dimensional world on an alien planet. You pick a character at the beginning and have to do something like activate a gate to get out of there or whatever. You have to go through maybe five areas or something before you get to what's considered the end game and have a choice of either stopping there or starting the loop over again.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the whole thing, you pick up better weapons and just upgrade your character and get super powerful. I really like the art style.
It does have a cool art style.
Yeah, it's a cool art style.
It's like that retro pixel art style.
Yeah, and when you get really powerful, it's just enjoyable kicking ass and just destroying everything in your path. There was a sequel announced not too long ago, and they've recently been putting video footage of it up, and it's a 3D successor to it. It looks really cool.
Wow. Taking it to 3D, that seems pretty ballsy.
Yeah.
2D is an integral part of that, like, side-scrolling adventure game.
I don't know. It's got a really good art style. You should take a look at the 3D successor to it. It looks really cool.
Do you know when that's coming out?
They haven't announced a release date. It's a small team working on it, and I imagine transitioning to 3D is probably
major undertaking.
Yeah.
And that's Risk of Rain 2.
Yeah, Risk of Rain 2.
Do you think that's going to be available this year?
Let's go with no.
We'll see. Yeah. Well, Spelunky 2, hopefully that'll be this year. We'll see.
Yeah.
Another game that which I know we wanted to talk about, which I was goading you on to purchase on Switch, is Death Road to Canada.
Yeah, which we both didn't like. We played at CGF before, and then you got it on sale. Works way better single player.
It works way better single player. Yeah. Exactly. Actually, I think it was really kind of my experience playing this game over the last few weeks, which made me really want to record this podcast in particular.
Right.
Because I found the roguelike qualities of Death Road to Canada so wonderful.
It's quirky,
so
enjoyable. And charming. Like,
there's such a huge amount of things which can happen as you're on this journey from Florida to Canada. And the writing in the game is really good. And it's just really entertaining as a game. And I still haven't beaten it. I've played it a whole lot. But it's so many funny random events which happen in the game, which just make it really enjoyable and makes it feel really different from a lot of other Switch games I've played recently. I finished Oxenfree maybe 1 month ago. I took a weekend trip to Beijing and played it for like 3 hours a day on my trip and finished it. And it was really enjoyable. I liked it, but I'll never play it again.
Yeah. And Death Road to Canada I beat, and I'll probably come back and try some of the other modes.
Yeah.
Just really fun.
It's just really fun. Exactly.
Yeah.
The game is, you control a car full of jerks as they explore cities, recruit weird people, rescue dogs, argue with each other, and face gigantic swarms of slow zombies. Randomly generated for a new story and rare events every time you play.
Yeah.
It's a really good game. Basically, yeah, it's a zombie apocalypse. It's basically like Oregon Trail. If you played Oregon Trail, which is where you're making the trip out west, and you have to navigate different obstacles to survive, it's like that. But it also has sort of Enter the Gungeon-esque action sequences, where it's more about using melee weapons than projectiles. Yeah. But you're basically navigating hordes in situations like Walmart or gas stations, grocery stores, etc. So it's those two things, and really fantastic game. Works perfectly on Switch. And it's funny because, like you mentioned, we played it previously at CGF.
Yeah.
I think when it was sort of a new release, actually. We played it at CGF. It just came out.
Ryan had picked it up and recommended we play it at CGF.
Right. It's a multiplayer game. It's retro styled. It's pixel art. And we thought it would be great for CGF. We played it. And it didn't work so good in multiplayer. We just didn't really have a sense for what was going on, how to win.
Yeah.
It felt kind of difficult. It felt kind of random. And it's not the type of game where you can just pick it up for the first time and in 15 minutes, like, have a great time. I think it takes a little bit more time to understand how the systems in the game work before you can really gain an appreciation for what's really good about Death Road to Canada. But when you play the game in single player on Switch, I think it's a lot easier to pick up those great elements inside for this game, the ones which we missed playing it in multiplayer.
Yeah. I think you compared it when you started playing on the Switch a little bit to FTL, and I can see similarities to the way that you're just moving forward through these, trying to get from Florida to Canada in the same way that in FTL you're trying to get to... What are you trying to get to?
You're trying to get to the master alien ship.
Oh.
Right.
Something like that.
But yeah, there's a swarm which is following you, which is chasing you, and you're trying to get to the master ship, whatever it's called. I forget.
Yeah.
In FTL. We'll talk about FTL next. I've got some interesting notes on that. But in Death Road to Canada, you are trying to go from Florida to the border up to Canada, and each day you encounter a number of random events.
Yeah.
You find new people who can join you. And one of my favorite features is that you can make custom characters.
Yeah.
And so I made custom characters. I made one for Snoop Dogg. I made him have the paranoid attribute, which is actually one of the most helpful ones.
Yeah.
Because you're driving around and it's like you see someone on the street and they're like looking for a ride. Like, should they join your party?
Snoop Dogg's like, don't pick that guy up.
Yeah. It's like Snoop has a terrible feeling about this.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go with Snoop's gut. Yeah. He's probably high, but I'll still go with it. Aside from Snoop Dogg, I also made Obama. I made Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I made Bill Nye the Science Guy. Just making these random characters is so funny because when you're playing the game, it's like Donald Trump appeared and he's in a car looking angry. Do you bash his car or do you race him on the street? And just think situations like that where when you put recognizable figures into it, it becomes really funny. And they kind of appear sort of organically in a bit of a Mad Libs way, where it's like there are certain random events which happen and then they're just populated with these custom characters which you create.
Yeah.
And it just makes a whole lot of fun and interesting situations.
Absolutely.
I've played the game. I think I've done like 12 runs or something now and still haven't beaten it. It's really difficult. Yeah, I found it pretty difficult.
I beat it and now I'm working on Shovel Knight. So I'm taking a break from Death Road to Canada.
Nice.
I think I beat it in 5 runs.
Yeah, so, but one more game we got to talk about, FTL.
Yeah.
We played the hell out of this game a couple years ago. I think it was maybe 2 years ago that we, I guess, had a challenge to race to see who could beat FTL first.
Yeah, and I beat you twice.
You know, you beat me in FTL. We played FTL once.
Yeah, but we beat it on the, like, hard mode, too.
Oh, did we? I don't think I even finished it on hard mode, did I?
Oh, no, but I did.
I don't know. Anyway, FTL is a space-based, top-down, real-time strategy roguelike created by indie developer Subset Games. It's actually made in China, in Beijing, and it was released on Windows, Mac OS, and Linux in September of 2012.
Hmm.
And it originally came from a Kickstarter success in September of 2012, and it got a whole bunch of buzz on Kickstarter.
Hmm.
And from there, it became a huge hit game. And it seems like it's fairly rare that this happens. A lot of games get funded on Kickstarter and just kind of don't pan out, really. Some of which I've contributed to. But I feel ashamed that I didn't contribute to FTL because I love the game so much.
Such a good game.
Yeah, and I knew about the crowdfunding campaign as it was going on. I just felt kind of pessimism around crowdfunding and indie games in particular because I feel like it's gone wrong so many times.
Worked out really well with that one.
And the same developers, the two guys from Subset Games, went on to make Into the Breach.
Which I still haven't played.
Yeah, which is not as much of a roguelike, actually. But it's still a fantastic game, still procedural generation, has a lot of roguelike features. And that is available now. That's been one of the top games of the last, I'd say, couple months. Very, very difficult game, though.
Cool. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. I would say that I probably prefer FTL to Into the Breach.
Yeah, you've said that a few times, I think. I still want to check it out. We've also seen, maybe in the last few years, kind of roguelite elements going into first person shooters a lot.
Yeah, you mentioned Heavy Rain. Any other ones?
Heavy Bullets.
Heavy Bullets.
Heavy Rain's
not Heavy Rain. Heavy Rain has different. Heavy Rain is the PlayStation game, which has no roguelike elements at all.
Yeah.
But Heavy Bullets, I love that game so much. I feel like that game.
I adore that game. Same, also Dose One person doing Enter the Gungeon soundtrack did the soundtrack for Heavy Bullets as well.
Great soundtrack.
Really good soundtrack. Really cool. Just exploration, focus on item management, all of these things. And when you have a strong character, you really get invested in that playthrough. It's really, really frustrating when you die, when you've made good progress in that game.
So frustrating. I'm dealing with that in Death Road to Canada right now. Yeah. I played so many runs. I'm pretty good at the game. I can get very close to the border reliably. Yeah. But when I get close to there, like some random event happens and it just screws me over completely. And I'm just like, damn
it. At your Switch.
Yeah, because you might have been playing for 30, 40 minutes and everything's going fine. And then one thing goes wrong and it just ruins the whole thing.
Yeah. I also really enjoyed Strafe, which is a lot different. It's less emphasis on the item management and exploration and just straight up run and gun shooter. But it's procedural. Yeah, it's like Quake, but with procedural generation and permadeath.
Right.
It's pretty cool. That game's a lot of fun. I really like the whole aesthetic of it. Makes the game. There's even a make the game look shittier option in the options.
Yeah, that's another Devolver Digital game.
Yeah, Devolver Digital.
A lot of these games are Devolver. Yeah, absolutely. A lot of really good games. I think Heavy Bullets was actually one that you kind of turned me onto a little bit. I think I played it, but you mentioned it or something.
I think I gave it to you.
Did you really? Yeah. That might be true. Yeah, a Steam Exchange or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have
played that game a whole bunch. And I highly recommended it, and you were just like, I don't like this. This is not for me.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, for whatever reason, at one point later, you revisit it and were just telling me, this game's great. This is really good. I can't stop playing it.
I do remember first feeling that the game wasn't for me and not really knowing what's going on because there's no instruction. It doesn't really tell you the rules. You kind of have no idea what's going on. And the whole nature of the game itself is that it's very atmospheric and abstract and a little strange and disorienting.
Absolutely.
One thing we didn't mention in this podcast, I wanted to mention, is the Berlin interpretation.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say that, too. The Berlin interpretation, pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, it's because of the expansion of so many roguelike games. Yeah. These were characterized at the International Roguelike Development Conference held in Berlin in 2008.
Right.
And they created a list which encompasses what is known as the Berlin interpretation of roguelike games. And it basically creates objective qualifiers for all the unique features of this genre, many of which we mentioned, like procedurally generated dungeons and permadeath and many more things like this.
And there's high value and low value things that they consider too, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. And they had five canon roguelike games they used to make the list, which was ADOM, Angbana, Lindley's Dungeon Crawl, NetHack, and Rogue.
Yeah.
The original.
Interesting.
I haven't really heard of any of those games.
I had neither.
Rogue.
And NetHack is also in that list of ones which were officially acknowledged in the Berlin interpretation. Most of these games are old. One, Tales of Majial, I don't even know that game, 2009. I'd never heard of it. That's on their list as well. A lot of the games which we've talked about in this podcast, including Spelunky, have directly adhered to many of the points in the Berlin interpretation. So it's kind of interesting that an organization, even though it's the Roguelike Development Conference in Berlin, you know, it's kind of like there's a conference around that. Yeah. I'm like a little surprised, especially in 2008, because in 2008, I mean, almost none of the games which we've been talking about in this podcast were available. I think 2008 was actually the first year that Spelunky was available when it was open source. Spelunky, actually, that's specifically mentioned here.
2005 onwards is kind of when we started to see this resurgence of popularity in the roguelite games, all these kind of more casual, accessible games. But there were a bunch of games before that, since the 80s being made, there were these deep, really complex games that I don't think the average user played. But obviously, there were a ton of people playing them, enough for there to be a conference in 2008.
Right. As we wrap this up, what you been playing recently?
Just trying to beat Shovel Knight, and this weekend playing a little bit of the Mario Tennis Aces demo. the online tournament. That's been pretty fun.
That's been really fun. This has been by far the best demo I've played on Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, it's super fun. It's like a full game almost.
It is like a full game. It's, for anyone who's unfamiliar, it's like a limited time weekend event, and it's a Mario Tennis Aces tournament. The game's not even out yet. I think it's coming out at like the end of this month, maybe.
Yeah.
And so the game is a free download, and you can basically play the entire game. I think the only real restrictions I've noticed is that you can't play two-player local, and you can't play with friends online.
Right, and you don't have access to all the character roster, and you don't have the single-player mission story mode or whatever.
Right, yeah, you mentioned that. Oh, you don't have the story mode. I'm like, yeah, you don't have the story mode in Mario Tennis. Like,
dude, I totally want to play that. There's like boss battles and all kinds of stuff that are kind of changing the whole gameplay element.
I think those are great things for them to add, and I'm not against those things being added, but I don't think that story mode is the reason why people play Mario Tennis.
Right, but I'll still play it if I get it.
Yeah, so that's been available this weekend. I've been playing that as well, and aside from that, you've been playing Shovel Knight. How far are you? You've been playing for like 5 or 6 hours now?
Yeah, I am at, what is it, the Iron Knight or something? I'm at, you know how you finish an area and it opens up the
Fog of War.
Yeah, so I'm at maybe the third area or whatever. I don't know how many there are, but I have 2 more levels to do in that area before moving on to the next one. I'm guessing I'm pretty far in the game. I have all of the shovel upgrades and I have the majority of the items.
What do you think of the game so far?
It's fantastic. It's really good, challenging, but not so challenging that I'm like, fuck, I can't do this. You know, it feels accessible enough. And you can make it harder if you want by doing those checkpoint things or whatever, breaking those open if you want to get extra money or whatever. But that, like, a couple times...
I didn't do any of that.
I did that, and a couple times it's really just fucked me over. I'm like, god damn, why did I do that? Like,
yeah, that would make a lot of sense.
So, but pretty cool, really rewarding, great artwork, great soundtrack, just satisfying gameplay. I think I'll probably beat it within the next week or so.
Hmm.
And then I think I'll finally get Mario Odyssey and move on to that.
Well, you got 2 more chapters in Shovel Knight.
Yeah, but I'm not going to just start them immediately. I think I want to move on to Mario Odyssey.
Hmm, okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
And then come back and play more Shovel Knight later.
Yeah, I've just been trying to beat Death Road to Canada.
Yeah, good
luck. Still playing that. I really enjoy it. I mean, as frustrating as it is, I feel like I should have beaten it by now, but it's
especially
really
considering
fun, so.
I beat it like way shorter period of time than you.
Yeah.
Luck of the draw, I guess.
I think luck's a big factor. You're good at video games too, so maybe you're better at this game than I am. I don't know. We'll see, but it's enjoyable.
Yeah.
The only thing that's frustrating is like when you get to the end and like something happens.
Yeah.
Like some random event, like you're driving on the road and it's like, oh, you hit a tree. Everybody loses like all their life. And now you're like, okay, now go into the final surge.
You haven't been to the border yet though, right? You've been at that siege just before
the final siege. Yeah. Exactly. That's right.
That one's super hard. I think that was harder than the last one. And I lucked out, dude. There is a policeman in the final siege that was in this room, and I just and
save
he was
him.
Just boom, 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 boom.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. That's exactly what it's all about, man.
Yeah.
What I've learned is that my strategy now is to have a chainsaw with gas.
I haven't got a chainsaw yet.
Oh, you haven't? Okay, so it just like slices through hordes of zombies.
Yeah, I just had a bunch of bombs. I had frag grenades, pipe bombs, Molotov cocktails.
Those are not that useful, I find. Molotov cocktail is, I guess, but in any case, once you get to the final siege, the siege is where you're restricted to an area in the game, and there's just a massive quantity of zombies which come inside, and you have to survive for a certain amount of time. It's usually
like
4 hours. 4 hours is a very long time.
That's
like a couple minutes in game time.
Yeah, that's what it was for me for the final siege. 4 hours.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So once you get totally overwhelmed with zombies,
they're
if
like
you have
falling
a chainsaw
through the roof,
if you have a chainsaw, then that gets you through them real quick. So that's what I've been working on. Anyway, Death Road to Canada, great game. Available on Switch, available on Steam.
How many hours
everywhere else
have you put into it?
I don't know.
Hmm.
Yep.
Cool.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you have interest in checking out other episodes, you can download them through your podcasting app or on our website at chundugaming.com. By the way, small note, the chundugaming.com website has been moved to a new server. So for a couple days, it was a little bit erratic. Apologies if you were trying to download an episode and had any trouble. Thanks for listening.
Later.